Thanks for joining us. I'm Laura Kanoy of New Hampshire Public Radio, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She's on vacation. This week, the U.S. marked the 10-year anniversary of the war in Afghanistan. Russia and China vetoed a U.N. resolution condemning Syria's ongoing crackdown on civilians. Germany pushed its neighbors to more strongly support Europe's banks. And the Nobel Committee awarded the Peace Prize to three women. Joining me in the studio to discuss this week's top international stories on the Friday News Roundup, Yoki Driessen of National Journal. And Yoki, it's nice to meet you. Thanks for being here.
Pleasure.
Also with us, Nadia Bilbasi of MBC TV. And Nadia, welcome.
Thank you.
And Mossimo Calabresi of Time Magazine. And Mossimo, thank you also for your time.
Pleasure.
Well, and Mossimo, I'll start with you. Today marks the 10th anniversary of the war in Afghanistan. We talked about this yesterday in the Diane Rehm Show, but I'd love to hear from you, too. What would you say, Mossimo, have been the primary achievements of this war, and what does the end game look like there?
Well, when you look at the statistics of what the United States has put into the effort in Afghanistan, it's really kind of staggering. Aside from the casualties, which are enormous, 1,700 plus dead American service members, 40,000 wounded. The amount of money, it's pledged $30 billion, $2 billion of it dispersed. We've built schools, we've built roads, we've built hospitals. It's been an enormous, enormous expenditure of time, effort, and money. Unfortunately, at this point, increasingly, the judgment on what all of that has achieved is looking less and less positive. The roads, some of them poorly constructed, are crumbling. We haven't gotten the kind of political stability that we imagined might come from that. And obviously, it's been a terrible summer in terms of the activities of the insurgency.
What are your thoughts, Nadia, on this 10-year landmark?
Well, this is interesting because this is the longest-running war in American history. The end game is clear, which is articulated by this administration, saying by 2014 we're going to withdraw more or less all of American troops from Afghanistan. They probably will leave few, just like the case in Iraq, to look after the embassy and maybe support the President Karzai if he's still there at the time. But I think it's really also intriguing to see that the White House is keeping a low profile on it. The president doesn't want to bring it as a foreign policy success. He doesn't want to talk about it because the facts on the ground, although they had some military successes against the Taliban, but if we look at the recent events with the attack on the embassy, at the American embassy in Kabul, with the assassination attempt or attempted assassination on the life of President Karzai, it shows that the country is very unstable. So even if they decided to withdraw, what kind of Afghanistan they will leave? The original aim was to destroy and to dismantle Al-Qaeda and the Taliban regime at the time, who was giving them safe haven. Now we know that Osama bin Laden was found in Pakistan. Most of the leadership of Al-Qaeda has been arrested or killed. And the threat for them is not really from Al-Qaeda. So what's the point of staying in Afghanistan? This is a very unpopular war by statistics that shows most Americans wanted to leave Afghanistan. And this president doesn't want to talk about it. He wants to talk about domestic issues. He wants to talk about jobs, jobs, jobs. The situation is very unstable. Many people will review it to see where they went wrong. Was Iraq was a distraction in pulling the forces and the resources? And the bigger issue is what you're going to leave behind when you withdraw the majority of American troops in 2014.
Yoki, go ahead.
Well, I mean, the end game, Nadia's right in terms of the military side of it, but the stated end game is very different than that and goes beyond it. The stated end game is peace talks with the Taliban. Peace talks confirmed this week with Haqqani Group, the most violent of the groups fighting there. That's what the U.S. wants to do desperately. There's no question in my mind. I spent 2 months there last fall. I spent about 2 years there in total. There's no question in my mind at all that if there was a credible peace deal to be had, doesn't matter about women's rights, doesn't matter about democracy, doesn't matter about the high-minded rhetoric, but if there was a peace deal that the U.S. would hold, they would take it in a heartbeat because that is the end game. The Massimo's point about the summer is well taken. June, and take it 1 month out of the summer, it was the largest number of IEDs ever. There were 1,600 IED explosions in June, which is staggering. The other thing that jumps out at me, if you compare a map now of violence in the country, a year ago it was in the south and the east. and you'd see little red dots in the north and the west, but that was it. Now if you look at that same map where each dot indicates attacks, it's everywhere. It's the north, it's the west, which had been totally quiet, it's still the south, it's still the east. And the last thing that I think is worth mentioning is, you know, Nadia's point again about al-Qaeda is spot on. What has always stuck with me since the bin Laden killing, Tom Donilon, the national security advisor, when there was the first big conference call, had this kind of chest-pounding moment where he said, there's been no al-Qaeda threat from Afghanistan for 8 years. And, I mean, think about that. This war has been justified, the surge has been justified, the expenditure of money that Massimo indicated has been justified as al-Qaeda. The point of view of the White House, as stated by its national security advisor, is there has been no al-Qaeda for 8 years. So something doesn't line up.
I want to remind our listeners that you can join us with your questions or comments throughout the hour. It's the International Hour of the Friday News Roundup. Our number is 1-800-433-8850, 1-800-433-8850. Send us your email at drshow@wamu.org, or you can join us on Facebook or Twitter. There were a couple news items that came out of the Afghanistan and Pakistan region this week. First of all, to you, Massimo, how has Pakistan reacted to Afghanistan's new security pact with India?
Well, this is their nightmare scenario that they have envisioned all along and which has driven their resistance U.S. support for the Afghani government. Traditionally, they have had this the fear of being squeezed between Afghanistan and India. So it is really what they are most worried about and confirms all of the things that they fear about a U.S. withdrawal. It's a big problem. It's another piece of bad news for the United States that they haven't been able to massage this diplomatically better. One point I wanted to make about the administration and its position at the moment, one is beginning to pick up a sense in the administration that with Bob Gates, the former Defense Department chief, now gone, the constituency for commitment to Afghanistan is also diminishing. So there are fewer and fewer people in this administration who are going to stand up and say, we have to really stick by this effort. And there's starting to be a sense that that 2014 date will not only be sort of a target and kind of a squishy date for the removal of combat troops, but that things might even get accelerated. And
before 2014.
Well, and that as soon as they can start disengaging, they're going to be looking for ways to do it.
Nadia?
The partnership was planned a while ago, according to the Afghanis. And basically, it meant to help the Afghanistan with support of India to build schools and to build hospitals and roads, etc. But what worries Pakistan in particular is this partnership regarding security training. And they worried about that. And I think it's no secret that the recent attempted assassination that was linked to Haqqani, that even some people in this administration believe that they have been support within the establishment in the ISI. So what Karzai does is he goes to India and he says, okay, maybe somehow it's been seen as I'm going to somebody who will protect me. Everybody is looking now what happened after 2014. The Pakistanis know that the Americans will leave and they have to look for this conflict that's always been seen through the lens between India and Pakistan, and all neighboring countries play a secondary role. So the Pakistanis wanted to increase their support or to the insurgent groups that they will have a voice after the American leaves, and the Indians wanted to have some kind of a partner or an ally in President Karzai or in the Afghani government after the Americans leave. So all of these things, I mean, I agree that the Americans seems to be not being able to diplomatically, although it's a huge conflict, and I cannot underestimate this conflict that these countries fought wars three times since independence in 1947, but saying at the least that the relationship between Karzai and President Obama wasn't really great, and between the Pakistanis and the Americans is not really great. So you have to look at all these complex issues and to see how can you ease the pressure somehow to make this relationship manageable after the Americans leave.
Well, and it's interesting, just listening to all of you, Yoki, it sounds like countries in that region know the United States is pulling out, and so they're realigning, rejiggering the pieces of the puzzle to prepare for that new reality.
100%. I mean, in some ways, the bigger news of this week wasn't the India deal. The bigger news this week was that Afghanistan, which had been working with Pakistan on peace talks, abruptly called them off. And very publicly, said Pakistan was not a partner, it was not helpful, it was not really playing in these peace talks the way the Afghan government thought it would. Bear in mind, this comes at the same time as the U.S. government has been criticizing Pakistan more openly and vitriolically than ever before. I just want to mention one thing about Masawa's point. Every indication I pick up within the Pentagon is that the drawdown, he's exactly right, will be significantly faster, significantly bigger than has been envisioned. And there are a couple of signs I think worth mentioning in brief. One is he's right about Bob Gates. General Petraeus, who had been the architect of that strategy, is retired now at the CIA, where he's basically invisible. Admiral Mike Mullen, who had fired the previous Afghan war commander, again, visibly in a loud voice in favor of the current strategy, retired and gone. The army has shortened its tours to 9 months and is trying to get people home longer. And there's an interesting, the fact that they picked, who they picked to replace Admiral Mullen is fascinating. They didn't pick a grand strategist. They didn't pick someone who had war fighting experience in Afghanistan recently, or actually at all. They picked Martin Dempsey, who's an older man, had been chief of staff of the army very briefly. His focus is on manpower. It's restoring the military after 9 years of war. It's budget cuts. It's things that are domestic. It's not the war. He's not a war fighter. So every indication is the Pentagon is reorienting from total focus on war to total focus on something very different.
That's interesting. So all these little decisions that don't make headlines, Yoki, are pointing in that direction to exactly. A sooner-than-expected U.S. withdrawal. We will take your calls after a short break. Our number here on the Diane Rehm Show is 1-800-433-8850, 1-800-433-8850. Email is welcome, drshow@wamu.org. Coming up, more of the International Hour of the Friday News Roundup, so stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Laura Kanoy, sitting in for Diane Rehm. It's the International Hour of the Friday News Roundup, and we welcome your comments at 1-800-433-8850 or email at drshow@wamu.org. And all of you, let's go to our callers now. And Hassan is calling from Alexandria, Virginia. Hi, Hassan. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. It looks like your panel is dancing around instead of addressing the main issue, and the issue is this. United States government, or the policy of United States government, is to support these dictators in the Middle East and pointing to them that if you want to stay in power, you have to stay with us. Now, we see the American military in the Middle East, in Bahrain, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, everywhere. People don't like that. That's why you can call the entire Middle East Al-Qaeda, because this is exactly what happened. We all know that the role of any government in the world is to protect the interests of the people. These dictators are not protecting the interests of the Middle Eastern people.
So the U.S. presence in the Middle East, he's saying, and I'll turn to you, Nadi, is inflaming anti-American feeling in the Middle East and helping Al-Qaeda.
Well, in a way, one of the grievances against American foreign policy for the last decades, regardless of which administration, is America's support for dictatorship in the Arab world. They've been propping them up for decades. Now the Arab Spring has changed everything, and Washington has to look again of how they're going to deal with the people in the Middle East through a fresh, a new foreign policy that's accountable to the people. I don't know if it's going to help Al-Qaeda or not, because what we have seen basically that the peaceful movement has inspired so many people to change regimes and debunk the extremist ideas, basically that only violence can lead to change of toppling of one party state or despotic regimes, and that has changed. But I agree with him that having American soldiers and military bases in the ground in the heart of the Middle East has been the cause in the beginning for the existence of Al-Qaeda, for Bin Laden, for many people who said that we don't want to see American forces on the ground because they are there to occupy our land, to steal the oil from Iraq, etc. They have very effective strategy recently, and we have seen it with the drone attacks, whether you can discuss about legality of it or not. But basically, using a plane that doesn't even have a pilot and targeting people and killing them has proven to be more effective than having thousands of American troops on the ground causing trillions of dollars, causing civilian death and American death, and that could be saved. So I think looking now, American bases in the Middle East never been popular, and you cannot compare it to bases in Germany or in South Korea. This is a different story completely, because Americans' foreign policy has been so much detested and hated in the Middle East. So having American soldiers represented by the army, it hasn't been a successful policy in the short run or in the long run. What they need is to see the good side of America, the USID, the projects, the volunteers that come in there to improve the people's quality of life, not the soldiers.
Okay. He mentioned Iraq. I was just there for about a month and came back recently, so I'm still mildly incoherent from jet lag. The disconnect between the debate here about troops and the debate there was staggering to me. Here, the question was always framed as, how many troops will Obama leave? Republicans said too few, Democrats said too many. But the basic idea was that it was his choice, that the U.S. could sort of choose how many to leave. We are, as Nadia said, more hated there than I was the bureau chief there for 3 years. I've been about 5 years there. More hated now than ever before.
Really? In Iraq?
In Iraq. They want us out. There's not a single political party other than the Kurds. None, no matter how pro-American. I spent some time with Ayad Alawi, the former prime minister. He was on the CIA payroll. He's as close to America as you can find in Iraq. And he refused to say that he thinks troops should stay and hinted strongly that he wanted them to go. Some of that is politics. It's an easier thing to say if you're a political leader that you want them out. But we are hated in Iraq. And there is no constituency saying we should stay, which is my gut is that I don't think there will be a troop extension. If it is, it's going to be tiny. It's not going to be 3,000. It's not going to be 2,000. It'll be 1,000 or 1,500. Because we are so deeply, deeply unpopular.
Hassan, thanks for that call. And again, our number 1-800-433-8850. And let's go next to Alex, waiting in Fairfax, Virginia. Hi, Alex, you're on the Diane Rehm Show. Go ahead.
I have a question and a comment. First, I completely agree with Hassan's comments. And with those in mind, I was wondering if your panelists could answer any figures about Afghani and Iraqi casualties, not just the American troops, but the Afghan and Iraqi citizens.
Yeah.
And my comment is just that I don't really, I've been against these wars from the beginning, and I don't really see an end to them. And I mean, now that Al-Qaeda is on its last legs, well, all of a sudden we have a new boogeyman, the Haqqani Network. Like, when is this really going
to
end?
Well, Alex, and thanks for calling. And, you know, to you, Massimo, it's hard to get a handle on Afghan deaths and Afghan casualties. But he's right. It's huge.
It is. I don't have an Iraq number off the top of my head. Yoki, I think, would. I saw the number for Afghanistan, and it was scores to 100,000 on that side. So obviously very large. I think to Nadia's point about drones, I think that that is becoming increasingly for the United States the new sort of PR problem in the Middle East. They are seen as a kind of a cowardly way of waging war. And at the same time, it's a tool that the U.S., as it reduces troops, and to the caller's question, when we're getting out, I think we are clearly headed in that direction. But as that happens, there is going to be a pressure to in the U.S., in the administration, to appear to continue to be actively prosecuting U.S. Security interests. And so the use of drones is likely to increase, exacerbating the problem that my fellow panelists have been describing.
You know, I appreciate Alex's question for a deeply moral reason. We focus here often on U.S. deaths solely. We lose sight completely of deaths of civilians. The numbers are squirrely. The figures from the UN, which tracks them, total are about 10,000.
This is for Afghanistan.
The figures for Iraq, according to the Iraqi Ministry of Health, is about 600,000.
Wow.
They range. The U.S. military's estimates are much lower, as you might imagine. There are estimates that go higher than 600,000, but the accepted figures are somewhere in the range of at least half a million Iraqi dead. And in Afghanistan in particular, the one thing everyone agrees with, regardless of source of numbers or whether it's 10,000 or 15,000, is that they're going up very sharply. The UN does a half-year report every 6 months about civilian casualties. The first 6 months of this year were the worst ever recorded. The number of attacks against them were up, number of overall deaths were up, number of Afghans maimed were up. So whatever figure you accept, the arrow, unfortunately, is pointing straight up.
I've seen even reports put in that Iraqi civilian casualties at 1 million, and we may never know the exact number. But I think just to put things in context, when 9/11 happened, it was the first, I mean, it was something so significant that has changed everything. And at the time when Al-Qaeda was seen as a group of people, they didn't belong to a country, they don't have a state. So when a state attacks you, maybe in war you attack that state. But in this case, they didn't have a state to hit back. So the United States went to Afghanistan because they thought this is the place where they can dismantle Al-Qaeda and they can hit them and hit the host that's been having them for a while. Iraq, it's debated is whether it was a war of a choice that the Bush administration at the time decided that this is the domino theory. If we can get rid of Saddam Hussein, then we can send a message to Syria and Iran, and we can change the Middle East through military force. And if they just waited till now, I mean, nobody can read in the future, in 2010 now, that we have seen in December that one man in Tunisia managed to topple a dictatorship, saving all this money, the treasury, the war, the casualties, the death, the destruction. The problem with Iraq now is not just, I mean, every life is regrettable. And if you talk about a million, you cannot really put your head around that figure. But the destruction of a national state. Now, if you talk to Iraqis, and maybe Yoki can illustrate, speak to that, there is no longer a project of nationalism united the Iraqis under the state of Iraq. It's people talk of themselves as the Sunnis and the Shiites and the Kurds. And now even this is reflected in employment and jobs and ministries. Everybody wants it to bring their own tribes to that. And this is, I think, one of the tragedies in the Middle East that is have highlighted the sectarianism that existed before, but it was highlighted after the invasion.
Well, one more question for you all on Afghanistan and Iraq. Here's an email from James who says, I wanted to say that I saw a lot of signs in Freedom Plaza yesterday demanding withdrawal from Afghanistan. I think the feeling was that the money would be better used domestically for jobs. One of you touched on this earlier, but Massimo, what do you think? How do you see President Obama and the Republican presidential candidates who hope to unseat him talking about some of these foreign policy issues that we're talking about right now?
Well, Obama is going to clearly project the message we've been describing, which is we're pushing forward but looking to wrap up, seeking peace. Yoki described the failed efforts in that regard. I think the Republican primary candidates have been very interesting to watch on this issue. Obviously, you've had the sort of fringe libertarian element in Ron Paul, who opposed all of the U.S. Interventions overseas.
And he gets big cheers when he says, bring them all home now.
He does. He doesn't represent a large block of the Republican Party, and in some cases he's been booed on that count and almost single-handedly has given Rick Santorum a place on the stage by giving him a foil to be the hawk, the traditional Republican hawk. But for other people, Rick Perry, not so much because he had trouble enunciating what his vision was. But for other people in the group, it's been a hot subject of debate. And today we have Romney giving his positions on this. But I think that you are likely to end up with a Republican Party consensus where it has been that and in fact that perhaps surprisingly is not far from where Obama is at the moment, which is giving the impression of strength and continuing the fight when, in fact, looking desperately for an exit.
Well, and Yoki, Mitt Romney is giving his first major foreign policy speech of his campaign as we speak. So there's a lot there.
There is. And to the point about Afghanistan, you know, Mitt Romney gave an answer that sounded like one thing and was interpreted by his fellow Republicans as one thing, which he was since trying to back away from. Specifically, he had this answer of saying, effectively, we should get out as soon as possible, subject to the advice of military commanders on the ground. His Republican colleagues didn't hear the second part. they heard "get out as fast as possible." They referred to him, in Rick Perry's words, as Obama light. Lindsey Graham referred to him as Jimmy Carter. These are not obviously compliments among the Republican friends who are listening to the show. But Afghanistan is a tricky issue for them because they are aware that the cost is huge. They are focused more for the first time in many years on deficits, budget cuts, than they are in the military. So they're sort of pro-war, hawkish, spend whatever you need to spend, fight as long as you need to fight. That's not the dominant voice anymore, and that's an interesting shift.
Thanks, James, for that email. I'm Laura Kanoy of New Hampshire Public Radio. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Again, if you want to join us, call 1-800-433-8850 or send an email to drshow@wamu.org. And Nadia, starting off with you, I want to ask about Syria. Mm-hmm. Russia and China came to Syria's defense this week. Explain.
Simple. Russia, I think, they learned from the Security Council resolution towards Libya, whereby the Western power led by the United States and the European Union wanted to protect civilians, but it's been seen as a tool to change regime. And the situation in Libya is still unfolding as we speak, and we hear statements from NATO and from the military general saying basically we are going to be there as long as civilians are not protected. So for the Russians, that was one reason, is basically they worried about this hegemony by the Western power, particularly the United States. Saying that, they said that they're against the violence. I mean, it was a great disappointment to human rights activists in Syria, to people who wanted the international community to do something. China want to sell arms, and they don't have a great record, both China and Russia, in terms of protecting human rights anywhere. So it was really, in a way, expected. The Syrian government seen it as a great victory for them, and advisor to President Bashar al-Assad, Muthaina Shaban, said it was a historic day. It shows that there is people who siding with, not siding with the power, who want to dominate the Middle East, etc., which is obviously her point of view. The problem with that, I think, is the United States and the European countries, mainly the European Union, wanted to provide some kind of mechanism to put more pressure on the regime if you have a UN Security Council resolution, not just unilateral sanctions by the US or the Europeans or Turkey now, who said that they're going to go ahead with it. But I think what's happening now, the danger of the veto is the resistance has been so peaceful for 6 or 7 months now. They have left with no choice. And we heard this new formed council in Istanbul, which is the Syrian National Council, saying, you left us with nothing, so we might resort to violence. So we might see some kind of a new direction in the desire to get rid of President Assad, that basically this resistance might turn violent and use arms to upset the Assad regime. And we have seen defection in the army itself. There was an interview on an Arab television recently by one of the commander who refused to open fires on protesters, saying basically we have 10,000 people. So it has the potential of civil war, and the situation might get messy. One of the other things I will add, that I read some news report today on the Arab media again, saying that the Assad family start selling their assets in Europe, in particularly in London. So they're anticipating that something might happen.
Really?
As you know, this regime is not just a regime that controls the majority being a minority, but it actually depends on the Alawite and the family loyalty. So it's the father pass it to the son, the brother is in charge of the army, the brother-in-law is in charge of the intelligence. So they have to protect themselves somehow. But I think it was a great disappointment to human rights activists for the vote.
Well, and a question for you, Massimo, and we could do hours and hours of programming just on this question, but why has Syria worked out so differently from other nations where we've seen the Arab Spring?
Well, the global interests are quite different. Internally, obviously, there's a number of differences. But just looking at the sort of the traditional geopolitics of it, Russia has had a close relationship with Syria for a long time throughout the Cold War. There's a deep history there. They may see an opportunity here coming out of the Arab Spring, which in some ways can, at least for the moment, be read as in the U.S. Benefit or interest to perhaps reconsolidate some of their influence in the region. The Chinese obviously have a number of internal political and ethnic issues with which they deal frequently using violence, and so don't like a precedent of international sanction against repression of internal minorities. Regime obviously has been willing to use violence in a way that other regimes were not willing to use. I think the United States, frankly, finds itself in confronting a good example of the limits of its power in this period. And I think that you get a sense of that in the responses of Susan Rice and the secretary to the veto, which were quite vituperative.
All right. Well, more of the international hour of our Friday news roundup in just a moment. We're going to take a short break. We'll take more of your calls when we come right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Constant Contact, offering local seminars for email marketing and social media. Learn more at constantcontact.com/local. By MetLife Foundation, committed to promoting healthy families and good nutrition, on the web at metlife.org. And by ESET, offering home internet security with parental controls to fight spam, viruses, and cybercrime. ESET.com. This is NPR.
Writer David Rakoff was just honored with the Thurber Prize for American Humor for his collection of essays, Half Empty, a funny book about the power of negative thinking. The book is now out in paperback. On the next Fresh Air, we feature an interview with David Rakoff. Join us.
Welcome back. I'm Laura Kanoy sitting in for Diane Rehm. It's the international hour of our Friday news roundup. Our guests are Yoki Driessen, senior national security correspondent for National Journal magazine, Nadia Bilibasi, senior U.S. correspondent for MBC-TV, Middle East Broadcast Center, and Massimo Calabresi, Washington correspondent for Time magazine. We're taking your calls at 1-800-433-8850 or email at drshow@wamu.org. And all of you, here's an email from Cara in Ann Arbor. She says, on the potential Greek bailout, could you ask your guests if they can give us a little better understanding of who would really be bailed out by what? It doesn't seem to be the Greek people. Are we really talking about another bank bailout where banks and speculators are demanding 100 cents on the euro for their risky investments? Cara, it's a great question, and I think I'll turn to you first, Massimo.
Well, on the specifics of who would be bailed out by whom, the European Central Bank and the European governments are looking to continue to float Greek sovereign debt. Governments, the Treasury in the United States issues bonds to fund the functioning of the government. Greece is the same. Greece is in the position where the markets expect the country not to be able to pay back the loans that it already has. And so the private markets are not paying to buy Greek bonds. So in order for Greece to continue to be able to pay its debts and not default on them, they need to get money from somewhere. And the problem has been that they've done such a bad job of servicing their debts in the past that many of the governments in Europe are not interested in being the ones to float them. The problem is that because of the crisis in Greece, it's very hard for anybody to see a way that Greece can avoid defaulting on their debts. The drop in GDP has made it harder and harder for them to stay solvent. They have all sorts of obligations, and even with massive cutbacks in what the government pays, either to pensioners or to government employees, there's been massive layoffs. They still don't have enough money to pay their obligations. And of course, the less the government spends, the more GDP drops. And it's very hard to see a projection that has Greece able to service its debt at this point.
But Greece also is it's an example to what happened to the rest of other countries, and you have to look at it carefully because you don't want it to drop out of the eurozone. Potentially, if they default on the debt, you're going to look at other countries that might have a similar position, like Portugal, all these weak economies, Portugal, Italy, Ireland, etc. But I think Greece in particular has been an interesting case because for the last few years, they have been having unrestrained spending. They have been lending so much money. It's a welfare state. And when Prime Minister George Papandreou came to power 2 years ago, funny enough, he came to say that he's going to help the poor and he's going to put taxes on the rich. But now for the last two months, basically, he's been basically reversing everything he has said in the election. And we have seen this massive strikes. I mean, it's not really a good time to go to Greece now if you're a tourist. Airports were closed, government buildings were shut down, people were demonstrating in the streets. It is a complete chaotic situation. And basically now he has to implement this austerity measures that is so severe that basically, as Massimo said, they have to cut 30,000 public jobs, public sector jobs. And they have to do so many things now to try to meet this 500 billion euro debt. And of course, who's going to come to their savior is Germany. And I think Germany being the largest economy in Europe, and they're the one who said that each eurozone country has to match the money that they're going to pay to Greece by their GDP. So I think it's going to be Germany and France. This is why it's a case study for the rest of Europe.
Boy, it's a tricky situation. And Yoki, to you, Germany has thrown its weight behind efforts to help Greece. Is this going to be enough to restore confidence and make people in the eurozone feel like life isn't going to fall apart?
You know, it's obviously always fun heading into a long weekend to talk about Greek bond yields and bank solvency all over the world. That actually is not true. The point about Germany, and nor is Greece anymore the focal point. The market assumes Greece is going to default, so Greece is in some ways irrelevant. What is relevant now is, and the caller hit on this, who gets bailed out. It's not Greece. And the specific issue right now that's dividing Europe is between Germany and France. French banks have the biggest exposure to German bonds of any other country. So France is at risk of having its debt rating cut just the way that the U.S. did, which has all kinds of problems, just as we're seeing here. France in particular wants €440 billion, I should say, from a common eurozone fund set aside for bailouts. Germany is refusing to allow that. The German argument is France is a rich country. France can afford to take a haircut on some of these bonds, and it is refusing to go along with the idea of bailing out French banks. And the German, what's happening basically, we can talk about this for a long time, but basically it's a Tea Party moment in Europe where, in the same way the Tea Party movement started by people saying, we have paid our debt for our mortgage, we're not going to bail out these no-good-nicks with their subprime mortgages, letting their houses get too big. That's what you're seeing now in Europe. Germany saves its money and invests carefully. It feels like France, Greece, they spend too much, they tax too little, and they've had enough. So you're seeing, in very Teutonic, understated ways, a Tea Party parallel that's exactly the same as what you're seeing in the U.S.
That's interesting. Go ahead, Nadia.
Just my understanding that the Troika, which is the Central European Bank and the Central and the European Commission and the IMF, are in Greece now. They're supposed to come up with this report on October 23rd to evaluate the situation. And the German foreign minister said that there is some positive signs. So we don't know if Greece is going to default or not. I don't know if it's just fait accompli that that's it and they have to move forward.
It's about buying time and a little bit of room to have have an orderly default as opposed to a chaotic default. If Greece defaults in a way that is out of control, it spooks the markets. The banks in the rest of Europe don't have a chance to capitalize themselves adequately to protect themselves against their losses, and you can have a panic in the credit market. So it's really about buying time.
You know, Massimo, I wanted to ask you about what Nadia said. More demonstrations this week. She's absolutely right. Is support for the demonstrators waning, or are you still seeing big demonstrations and lots of support for those?
Well, given that the cuts are going to get deeper the more these negotiations continue for access to money, and the more Greece has to continue to pare its expenditures, one would expect them to grow. Frankly, the number of people, as Nadia says, who are going to be affected by this is enormous. And frankly speaking, they know that much of the money that is going to be coming in is not going to be going to them. It's going to be going to the budget, and it's going to be going to the banks. So they don't have an enormous amount of incentive to come off the street.
But one point I will add, too, about Greece is it has one of the most organized unions in Europe. And these protests has been led by this two of the largest unions. And I think they're there to stay because they're protecting the jobs, especially in the public sector. So I will agree that we'll see more and more demonstrations in the street. And as the more of the austerity measures been implemented, the more angry people are. And they were saying, if my family lost their jobs and we don't have money and my pension has been cut and my retirement's going up, I don't care what's going to happen to the country because it's already affected my family.
But to Yoki's point, almost the most important political development and grassroots political development to watch is the one in Germany and the extent to which Angela Merkel can manage an increasingly unruly political situation there as she tries to do what everybody says needs to be done, namely for Europe to come together more forcefully and organize its response to this in the face of domestic political pressures, which are pushing in exactly the opposite direction.
I want to turn our attention back to the Middle East and talk about Israel. And Yoki, to you, Defense Secretary Leon Panetta made some waves about Israel this week. What did he say?
So he was echoing something that Bob Gates said when I was with him, Bob Gates in Israel earlier in the year. His argument was that Bob Gates' argument, and Panetta, frankly, is continuing it, that Israel is going to find itself more isolated than ever because it's not responding to the demographic trends sweeping other countries or to the Arab Spring. Bob Gates' point, and again, it's Panetta's point as well, there's total continuity, is that there's a moment now for Israel which is different than in the past. There's, on the one hand, uncertainty. Allies like Mubarak are out of power. Syria, with which it's had a cold peace that it kind of trusts, is in a state of flux. So there are real concerns for Israel, but the notion they're saying is that Israel is more and more isolated and putting itself more and more in risk. One of the problems, and it's a big one, is that the current Israeli government, the current American government, don't get along at all. On the military side, the Pentagon and the Israeli military do. By a lot of measures, that's a better relationship than ever. But Netanyahu hates and does not trust Obama. It's a strong word that I use carefully. And Obama hates and doesn't trust Netanyahu. So these words are strong words when you say Israel's being isolated. That's a fear in Israel because it sees itself isolated at the UN. It knows it's isolated within Europe. But the underlying issue is this complete lack of affection or trust between the two leaders. You can, depending on one's politics, you can blame Obama for it, blame Netanyahu for it, but there's no question that that exists as a reality.
Let's take another call. Again, our number here in the Diane Reem Show, 1-800-433-8850. And to Sam in Bainbridge, Georgia. Hi, Sam, you're on the Diane Reem Show. Go ahead, please.
Yes, ma'am. I got a question for Nadia about, does she believe there is a media kind of warfare against the Syrian government supported by the Saudis? And if you listen to the Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya, you could sense there's hatred in this news segment, and you listen to the Syrian TV and watch the, and you see people walking, shopping, just normal life. My question is also, did she hear about the son of the Mufti of Syria that he got killed by those people? And also recently, the Al Jazeera had a little segment on a 22-year-old young female from Syria that was killed and was tortured. And she was alive, and with her ID card on the Syrian TV. So, does she know that there's a media war?
All right, well, Sam, let's talk about that. Yeah, the media reporting on Syria.
This is a sub point, and I think it shouldn't distract from the fact that the UN Human Rights Commission has came up with the recent report saying 2,900 people have been killed. In addition to that, there's thousands of people, according to human rights organizations, including Amnesty International, said they've been in jail and mainly disappearing. So we don't know. So the actual number of casualties might run into tens of thousands. Now, if the Arab media hasn't been objective in their coverage, I will ask the Syrian government to open their doors to the international media. If they don't trust the Arab media, why is it that they have prevented every single international journalist from entering the country to see for themselves? Now, we know that government televisions, unfortunately, in the Arab world, hasn't been objective, to say the least, and to say that they blatantly just put in lies and taking the government point of view, whatever they dictate to them. So government television in the Arab world is a joke. Nobody takes them seriously. I'm not saying that the pan-Arab satellite medias don't have an agenda, and they haven't been also been objective in their coverage because they can pick and choose, and some will say they're focusing on Syria and in Egypt and Tunisia, and they're ignoring Bahrain, despite the fact maybe the casualties are not the same, but I won't say that they have been completely innocent in their coverage. But what I say to the caller is, it's true that the media plays an important role, and we have seen it in Egypt, in Tahrir Square, where the American media, the European media, the Chinese media, everybody was there telling the world that the revolution was televised. In Syria, the government know that this is a very important message to the world to see what's happening. So the only pictures that we have is YouTube and activists that leak these pictures at the expense of their life. So the bottom line, yes, it's not a media war, but it's a lack of information that's coming from Syria. And the only way we can address that balance, is allowing the international media to operate freely in Syria.
Right. Well, Sam, thanks a lot. And it's an important point. Our number, 1-800-433-8850. I want to turn to another story coming out of Europe, and to you, Massimo. I think German authorities have reopened dormant investigations into suspected Nazi war criminals. Why now?
Well, I will tell you honestly, I don't know why they've reopened it. I am somewhat surprised to see them tackling a thorny issue right at this moment. Maybe Jochi has some opinion.
Jochi.
I mean, frankly, the answer is what we might expect. These people are dying. The window is closing very rapidly to try to have any kind of accounting or any kind of justice, and the Germans are well aware of that. I mean, one of the cases that they've reopened is a case that was a huge case here for many, many years, case of John Demjanjuk out of the U.S. You know, he always claimed he was innocent. Multiple historians, investigators, lawyers have claimed for decades that this man was one of the worst of the worst. This was a sadistic prison guard who personally tortured and killed thousands upon thousands of prisoners. So what's happening in Germany now is a kind of last-ditch attempt to try to get as many as they can before that generation dies, and by dying is frankly free from justice.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Again, if you want to join us, you can call 1-800-433-8850 or email drshow@wamu.org. Another story that we should cover, this was big international news. I was in the airport on Monday. I couldn't escape it. It was on the television everywhere. And Massimo, that's Amanda Knox, released from Italian jail this week after her murder conviction was overturned. We don't need to hash through this whole case, obviously, but has her case received as much attention in Europe as it has here?
Well, it has received a considerable amount of attention over there. It has received a huge amount of attention here. I think that, the British tabloids obviously had their interest in the case because of the victim's connection there. I think that there are fewer substantive issues involved in this story than there are general public interest questions. This is a young woman who has spent 4 years in prison, and so Americans are interested in hearing about that.
And last but not least, by far, Nadia, the Nobel Peace Prize winners were announced just today. Who are these three women who won, and what were they honored for?
Okay, well, this is, first of all, a great day because it's been a long, long time since a Nobel Prize for Peace has been awarded to women, and to have not just one woman, but to have three women. So let's start talking by the Yemeni, which is, I have to say, as an Arab woman, I was very touched and very proud to have the decision has been given to a Yemeni activist. Her name is Tawkil Karman. She's been a human rights activist. She has been leading this protest movement in 2007, and I think this is the measure that you have to look at. It's not when the country as a whole stands against a regime, but when a woman starts a movement long before anybody put the spotlight on the country. Yemen is one of the most kind of, in a way, backwards societies in the Middle East because of the situation with women in terms of a tribal discrimination against women. And this woman did not fight against women's rights only. She's standing against dictatorship. She wanted a society that's accountable. She wanted to fight corruption and nepotism. She wants better opportunities for everybody. And this is great. And I think that the decision may be political because it was given to the Arab Spring in general. It's given to a country like Yemen. It wasn't given to Egypt. It wasn't given to Tunisia or to the traditional women that the West like to see westernized and modern and smokes and have miniskirt. This woman is the real deal. She has a veil. She stands. She's a mother. She set up an organization to fight against the freedom of expression. She wanted a better society. And she's been sitting in the square that inspired so many women. We're running out of time. I wanted to talk about the president of Liberia, of course.
Just give us the name.
Eileen,
real quick.
Yeah. Eileen Sirleaf, who also was the first woman president. And another woman, her name is Lima Boy, who also has been instrumental in bringing Muslims and Christians together in Liberia to fight civil war.
And we will end it on that. Nadia, thank you so much. Thank you all of you for being with us today. I'm Laura Kanoy, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Lisa Dunn, and Nikki Jex. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales.